Well, good morning. Well, I don't want to say that there were some technical issues when I came in this morning, but let me just advise those of you who may be doing PowerPoint presentations up here in the future to make sure that your version of PowerPoint matches nicely with the version of PowerPoint that's in here. Yes, really. So Aaron helped me out. We were able to, I hope, get things straightened out so that I don't have to tap dance too much with this presentation. If you know me and my presentation style, you know that I like to illustrate certain things with classical pieces of art that reflect Bible scenes. I love, when I've traveled both abroad and in this country, I love going into cathedrals because of the depictions of biblical scenes on the walls. I just find them to be fascinating how artists of the day illustrated parts of the Bible. So this is one that we'll be talking about a little bit today, the prophet Elijah and the widow of Sarepta, or Zarephath, as it's also referred to in various translations. And we'll be talking about this particular episode, among others, in Elijah. So yeah, this is entitled Elijah, the Ants, and the Clay Jar. And you can see up there a couple of pieces of clay jar that are part of the story of Elijah. I need to point it back here. Are we good or not? All right, so I'm going to talk a little bit about the highlights of Elijah's life before we get into some of the details. Elijah is illustrated in the book of 1 Kings. Aaron, are we good with this? Are you going to have to do this manually? We don't know. Whoop, all right, a little late. So he shows up in 1 Kings chapter 17, and he just shows up. He's from this place, Elijah, what's the name of the place he's from? I forget. Anyway, he just shows up. Tishbe, he's called Elijah the Tishbite. And he shows up to and confronts Ahab about his worship of Baal and his wife's worship of Asherah. And in the religions of the time, the multi-theism of the time, they were married, and they various sects and cults worshipped Baal. And God had had enough and sends Elijah to confront Baal. And then after he confronts Baal, he escapes to this place, so the Kerith Ravine, and he's sustained by God and he tells Ahab there's not going to be any rain until Ahab repents for a long time, until he says otherwise. So then he escapes, and he's fed by ravens and drinks out of the brook at this place called Kerith Ravine. And, you know, I wonder what those ravens brought him. I mean, little things in Scripture sort of fascinate me. What did these ravens bring him? I mean, especially in time of drought, there's no rain. The fast food places would have been shut down. I just don't know I'm not sure I want to be fed by ravens, but if there's no alternative, I guess we'll go with that, right? And then after the brook dries up, he goes off and he meets the widow in the picture up there at this place called Zarephath. And the definition of this is a place of refinement, of purification, of maybe focus for Elijah. That's what the word Zarephath means. So after a while there, he is sustained. She says, "Hey, I'm starving. I really can't feed you." He says, "Hey, don't worry about it. You've got this jug and this jar, and God's going to keep it sustained. I'm just going to sustain you through this for a while." And in fact, God does this. Miraculously, the oil in the jug, the flour in the jar, they are maintained through for a really, really long time. And during this time, her son dies, this young man up here, and she confronts him and says, "What's the matter? Why'd you come here just to bring trouble on me and my son?" and he's dead. What are you going to do about it? And he says, I'll take care of it. And in fact, he raises this young son back to life, and she says, I know that now that you are telling the truth about who you are. And then he runs off to this episode in Mount Carmel, at Mount Carmel. I had a friend years ago that said that the story of Elijah would make a fascinating musical. And it would. I mean, you got great characters, you got tension, you got sex, violence, low points, high points. It would make an awesome musical. And this may be the high point of the theatrical production, is when Elijah is on Mount Carmel and he calls down fire from the heavens to consume this sacrifice that's on Mount Carmel. Before he gets there's a couple little things that I find to be fascinating in Scripture. One is that he runs into this guy named Obadiah, who's another prophet, and he tells to Obadiah, hey, tell Ahab I want to meet with him. It's time for us to get together. And Obadiah says, what? I don't want to do that. He's mad. He's mad at you. He'll be mad at me. He says, don't worry about it. And Obadiah says, you know, I want you to know that I've also hidden 100 prophets in a cave, 100. Not 101, not 99, there's 100 in two caves. And he's able to bring them, again, during this course of famine, food and water, 100 prophets of God he's got hidden in caves. Like, where are they? And what are they doing in the cave? Are they prophesying together? Do they have, like, focus groups to what we're going to prophesy about? These sorts of things just sort of stick in my brain. And then Ahab, when he gets with Elijah, calls him, you troubler of Israel. Really? Can't you do better than that? Today, I mean, I think we'd have a little more fiery pronouncements rather than you troubler. You ever go up to somebody that you're mad at and say, you troubler? No, you don't say that. That's an interesting use of language, you troubler of Israel. Elijah says, nah, it's not me, it's you, bud. And then he also says, we're going to meet on Mount Carmel, and I want you, Ahab, get your prophets, your 450 prophets of Baal, and the 400 prophets of Asherah, who, get this, who eat at Jezebel's table. Like, do they have this table on a football field? Well, where do they put these 800 people that eat at Jezebel's table? I think it might have been a figurative thing rather than a literal thing. It said, who will eat and commune with Jezebel, you and Jezebel. There's 850 of these people. Get them together, the people of Israel. We're going to meet on Mount Carmel. So he goes to Mount Carmel, and he does his thing. The fire comes down, and Elijah, he's got to be feeling it. Yeah, we did it. I'm going to run all the way to this place called Jezreel, which is where the palace was, 15 to 20 miles away or so. He runs. He beats Ahab down there and gets in front of Jezebel, said, what are you going to do now? And she says, and by the way, they slaughter the 800 prophets, the 850 prophets from Baal and Jezebel. She says, if you, what's the word she uses? I'm going to read it. Well, this is a really good business. This is a little more than you, troubler of Israel. This is chapter 18. 19. All right, so Ahab tells Jezebel everything. Elijah comes down. Jezebel sends a messenger to Elijah to say, may the gods deal with me, be it ever so severely, if by this time tomorrow I do not make your life like one of theirs. So what happens? Elijah runs off, escapes to the desert. He's really mad. Now it's kind of a downer because he's really flying, of course, after this episode on Mount Carmel. And he sits under a broom tree. I tried to look one up, not sure what it is, some tree out in the desert. He says, God, I'm of no use. Why, you know, take my life. I may as well be dead. God says, no, I have other plans for you. So later in the story, he goes off Naboth's vineyard. Ahab and Jezebel, through a series of evil actions, steal this guy's vineyard. And Elijah comes back in and tells them, you know what? You didn't do this. You're going to be dead, and dogs are going to eat your blood, eat you up from the sidewalk, lick your blood. Okay. And then he runs off again, and ultimately he's taken to heaven in a convertible, a chariot, sorry. Ultimately, he's taken to heaven in a chariot. Eventually, of course, the prophecy does come true where Ahab is killed in battle, and Jezebel, I think that's right, isn't he? I think he's killed in battle. And then Jezebel, sitting on a window ledge, is tossed out the window, falls to the ground, dogs eat her up. Now, here's an interesting thing I learned. Jezebel's death was by defenestration. Have you ever heard this word? You have? It's death by throwing somebody out a window. I'm totally not kidding. So, I learned this. Anyway, Jezebel's tossed out the window. She dies. Dogs eat her up. The prophecy came true after Ahab was taken to heaven. That's important. Yeah, defenestration. Who knew? The German word for window is Fenster, and the technical term for openings in the sides of buildings is a fenestration. I learned that in the roofing business. Anyway, so here are some of the highlights, but I want to focus on particularly the jar that's referred to in chapter 17. This is a picture of a jar that's about concurrent with the life of Elijah, and I don't know where it was found, but it's he lived around 800 BC, something like that. And so this jar would have been typical of the jars could have been found in that period of time in this part of the world. Now, this is a small one. It's according to the description that I found. It's only like 4.5 inches by 4.5 inches, but it could have contained things, including perhaps flour or other items of value. And if you look at the story, this is the most valuable possession that this widow has. It's got her life essence, her flour in it, and there's a comparable one for the olive oil. But the reason that it's in a clay jar and not in a basket or a sack is to protect it from insects, including the ants that would have been around at the time. Can't store your grain in a sack on the floor. Can't store it in a basket. The ants will get it. So it's in a clay jar because it's her most important possession to ensure her life and protect it from the elements. So also, if you know me, you know I can't get through a sermon without showing a Far Side cartoon. So people are, of course, that they're desperate. They're sitting on a lifeboat somewhere. And we've all heard of army ants, but Gary Larson, who drew the Far Side, said, well, why aren't there Navy ants? So apparently these people are accosted by Navy ants, are going to attack them and make their lives even more miserable than it already is. And so if you look sort of figuratively at Elijah. Elijah's got a spiritual jar. It's his very being. And his spiritual being, his existence, his physicality, whatever you want to call it, his spiritual jar, not physical jar, is being attacked by ants throughout this story. He's living in a repugnant society, repugnant culture. Okay, things that are offensive both to him and to God. He's wanting in a couple of places. The Kerith Ravine situation, he's wanting. He's by the creek. He has to be fed by ravens. We already discussed that. Maybe if you're desperate, you wouldn't mind being fed by ravens. But he's wanting. He's living in an intolerant society. Jezebel and Ahab don't tolerate his spirituality, his godliness, his truth. He might feel disadvantaged. He's on Mount Carmel. There's 800 of these prophets screaming and yelling and cutting themselves, and he's by himself. He might feel at a disadvantage. He's unwanted. He runs down to Jezreel. Jezebel says, if my life, if your life, if you're not dead by tomorrow, let the gods deal with me severely. He's unwanted. And then he feels insignificant. He runs off to the desert. He's underneath this broom tree. He feels insignificant. And there are other ants, pardon my little punning there, other ants that may be affecting his life as well. All right, so here's where it gets interesting. So Elijah's clay jar, if we look at his life, and I'm going to read some of these passages about what constitutes Elijah's clay jar. One is he was punctual. He was, at the beginning of the story, when he goes out and he just immediately shows up to confront Ahab about his idolatry. There's not going to be any rain until I say so. But he's right where God needed him to be at the right time. He was tuned in to where God needed him to be, and he was punctual. He was there when he needed to be. He was sustained, as I mentioned before. He was sustained by God, by these ravens, by the widow with her flour and oil. He was taken care of. He was a truth teller. The remark that the widow at Zarephath makes to him after he raises her son is, "Now I know that you are telling the truth." There's really not any record of their conversations that they had other than, you know, give me food and water. She says, I don't have any. There's really not a lot of conversation that's recorded, but he must have been telling her the truth, telling her honestly about his relationship with God while he was staying with her. He was a servant. 18. So I'm going to read this passage. It's 18. This is Mount Carmel. And he's telling these priests of Baal and Ashereth to cut up the bull, cut up the sacrifice, douse it with water, and they try to get fire from their god to make things happen. But of course, it doesn't. No matter how much they scream, how much they cry, how much they cut themselves and otherwise try to grab the attention of their god. So it didn't happen. And then in chapter 18, verse 36, at the time of sacrifice, the prophet Elijah stepped forward and prayed, "O Lord, God of Abraham, Isaac, and Israel, let it be known today that you are God in Israel and that I am your servant and have done all these things at your command. Answer me, O Lord, answer me so that these people will know that you, O Lord, are God and that you are turning their hearts back again." Then fire of the Lord fell, burned up the sacrifice, the wood, stones, and the soil, and also licked up the water in the trench. It wasn't this magnificent display of theatrical display, if you will, of him being a prophet of God. It was him being a humble servant, as he mentions in this passage. Okay. Then, as I mentioned, he runs off, goes down to Jezreel. Jezebel kicks him out, threatens him. He runs off to the desert. And we're on chapter 19 now. Elijah was afraid and ran for his life. That's verse 3. When he came to Beersheba in Judah, he left a servant there while he himself went a day's journey into the desert. He came to a broom tree, sat down under it, and prayed that he might die. "I've had enough, Lord," he said. "Take my life. I'm no better than my ancestors." Then he laid down under the tree and fell asleep. But God certainly hears his prayer, but he says essentially the following verses, "I'm not done with you yet. Okay, hang in there. Thanks for praying to me." He's visited by angels, and then the Lord tells him to go and do some other things. And one of the things that he does is go and tap Elisha, who succeeded Elijah in sort of his ministry there. So anyway, he devoted himself to prayer in this case. He's also, and to find this one, you'll see why in a little bit, he's God's adjutant. That means assistant, aide. It's used often in military terms, where he is, he's able to get down after the Naboth's vineyard. Naboth had this vineyard. Ahab and Jezebel wanted it. Naboth said, nah, I'm not selling it to you. They had him killed, and then so that they could just take control of it. And Elijah comes down to Ahab to talk to him. And Ahab, again, with one of these really sort of mild epithets, says, so you found me, my enemy, you troubler of Israel. And he is God's adjutant. He's representing God in front of Ahab and Jezebel. He says, I have found you because you have sold yourself to do evil in the eyes of the Lord. I'm going to bring disaster on you. I will consume your descendants and cut off from Ahab every last male in Israel, slave or free. He goes on and he says the same thing about Jezebel. Dogs will devour Jezebel by the wall of Jezreel after she was defenestrated. Dogs will eat those belonging to Ahab and who die in the city, etc. And then the God's on to say, there was never a man like Ahab who sold himself to do evil in the eyes of the Lord, urged on by Jezebel, his wife. He behaved in the vilest manner by going after idols, Amorites, the Lord drove out. By the way, Ahab was like just the latest in a list of four or five other kings of Israel who were really bad guys. You know, you read the preceding scripture and it says, and this particular king did evil in the eyes of Lord or whatever. And so he was just the next in line, these guys, but God had had enough. So he's God's adjutant. He's being God's messenger, his delivery mechanism, his aid in confronting Ahab and Jezebel. And then ultimately he's glorified. If we turn over to 2 Kings chapter 2, he's already hanging out with Elisha, and they're wandering around, and Elisha is being told by several people that, hey, you know that Elijah is going to be taken from you, right? And he said, yeah, I know. But in 2 Kings chapter 2, verse 9, they're wandering around, Elijah and Elisha, and Elijah says to Elijah, tell me, what can I do for you before I am taken from you? So he knows that God is going to take him away. And in fact, right after this, as they were walking along and talking together, suddenly a chariot of fire and horses of fire appeared and separated the two of them. And Elijah went up to heaven in a whirlwind. That's a pretty glorious exit, I'd say. Pretty cool. And then the story is sort of picked up by Elisha as his, his apprentice, so to speak. I don't know. So these sorts of things. Now, all right, Aaron, is this going to work? So this is Elijah's spiritual clay jar. I had this really excellent animation that was going to make this pop, but I hope that you can see that this is taken from the red letters in the descriptions, the clay jar, and what constitutes Elijah's makeup, and what allows him to resist infestation by the ants. Okay. Keeping what's precious inside, safe. His covenant with God, essentially. There we go. So, we also, as I demonstrated up here earlier, we're a clay jar. We're a spiritual clay jar. To reiterate what Mari read in 2 Corinthians, For what we preach is not ourselves, but Jesus Christ as Lord, and ourselves as your servants for Jesus' sake. For God, who said, "Let light shine out of darkness," made his light shine in our hearts. Thank you, Brian, again for leading that song, "Sunshine in My Soul." Let light shine out of darkness. Made his light shine in our hearts to give us the light with the knowledge of God's glory displayed in the face of Christ. But we have this treasure in jars of clay to show that this all-surpassing power is from God and not far from us. We are hard-pressed. We're attacked by the ants on every side, but not crushed. We're perplexed, but not in despair, persecuted, but not abandoned, struck down, but not destroyed. We always carry around in our body, in our clay jar, the death of Jesus, so that the life of Jesus may also be revealed in our body. So, do we often find ourselves surrounded by repugnant practices? I'd say we do. Are we in want? Maybe not physically, but maybe spiritually or emotionally. Are we living in an intolerant society? I'd say that that's true. Do we feel disadvantaged, alone against the world, much like Elijah felt perhaps on Mount Carmel? Do we feel unwanted, maybe rejected? Maybe people we thought would be receptive to us, they're not really interested. You're not wanted by them. Do we feel insignificant? Where do I fit in? Am I under the broom tree wondering what's going on? Where do I fit in God's grand plan? I would suggest to you that we maybe learn from the life of Elijah regarding our own clay jar, to be punctual, to understand, to listen for God when he's speaking to us and be available when he asks us to be available, to be confident that we will be sustained by him, much like Elijah was physically. We may need to be sustained emotionally, spiritually, that we tell the truth when given the opportunity, that we are a servant to others who are in need, that we exercise a prayer life. We take our petitions before God with the expectation he'll answer them. That we're his adjutant, that we're his assistant on earth, his aid when it comes to fulfilling his work on earth. And the expectation that we will be glorified, the knowledge that we'll be glorified, maybe not in a chariot with horses, oh, that would be cool, but that we have the expectation as Christians of being glorified and taken to heaven in glory one day. Okay. All right, Aaron, thanks. We got through it okay. So with that, I would ask you to please stand and sing our closing hymn.